Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Thank you for joining us. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Abstract expressionism was taught as a moment in 20th century art, often concentrating on the works of artists like Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, and Cy Twombly. This is a time frame in an artistic movement you probably think of. You imagine a prototypical New York artist, broke, jean-clad, self-serious. But the notion of this time in U.S. art history being led exclusively by men is, well, untrue. Not only were women a part of this incredible time, they were often at the center of it, shifting trends, breaking barriers on equal footing with the men on the scene. This is the backdrop for a new book by Mary Gabriel. It is called Ninth Street Women, Lee Krasner, Elaine de Kooning, Grace Hartigan, Joan Mitchell, and Helen Frankenthaler, Five Painters and the Movement That Changed Modern Art. The New York Times named it one of nine books to recommend this week, and Mary Gabriel joins us. Thanks for being with us, Mary.
Well, thank you so much, Allison.
That was exciting to see that your book was on that list. Exciting.
Yeah, it's always wonderful to see it.
So tell people, what was this Ninth Street Art Show in May of 1951? What was it and why was it important?
It was just a really fantastic coming out party for the artists who today, you know, we think of as household names, the artists who actually defined what it was to be a modern American painter. And what had happened was up until about 1950, the artists in New York were working so underground that no one recognized them. There were about two or three galleries that might show their work. There were one or two critics who might recognize it. But really, they were painting for and among each other. But by 1950, Jackson Pollock had been featured in Life magazine. And so the mass media, the kind of mainstream press, started nibbling around the edges of that world. And the artists realized that unless they came out and declared themselves, they risked being defined by these other people who really didn't understand what they were getting at. So they decided to have a show. And on 9th Street, there was a furniture store that was empty because the building was about to be demolished. And so they rented the space for a month, as you say, in May 1951, and took it over, whitewashed it, built walls so that there would be enough exhibition space, redid the lighting, sent out invitations and waited. And the result was this incredible, clamorous dialogue, painting to painting, artist to artist, and artist, most importantly, to the outside world. And so that's what the Ninth Street Show was. And it really, from that moment, the modern art world shifted from Paris to New York and you know, I guess arguably has dominated ever since.
So when you say who did they invite? Who was important to be at that show at that time?
Yeah, there were 72 artists. Not all of them were on the invitation because some were admitted late, like Robert Rauschenberg, for example. He was at first rejected by Leo Castelli, Leo Castelli at that time was no one. He worked for his father-in-law in a textile business, and the artists asked him to hang the show because it was just such a delicate mission. And Rauschenberg came in with his painting and showed it to him. He said no, because it was a white on white, and he thought that went too far. But the artists clamored and said, you know, Rauschenberg had to be in. And so he was. So the names are people like de Kooning, Pollock, Bob Motherwell, Ibram Lasso, David Smith, the sculptor. Just, you know, names that we take for granted now as the masters, the great masters of modern American art. But wonderfully and significantly, among those 72 artists were 11 women, five of whom I chose to write about.
And of the five women who were in this show, can you describe the paintings that they had in this Ninth Street Art Show and what tells about us about them?
Yeah, I would love to be able to describe all five. I can't, unfortunately, because there's a record for two. I think Jones is fairly clear. Grace Hartigan had just arrived on the scene in 1948, having not really been a painter at all. And so her first painting was called 6x6, the one she submitted to the show. It was very much searching, a lot of Pollocky and de Kooning-like jabs, sitting on the surface and creating kind of a woven depth. But it was in no way what Grace would evolve to. Although, it's interesting when you do look, and I'm glad you asked that question, because when you do look at the initial works, and I include examples of all of these women's initial kind of paintings when they first started, you can see where they will ultimately go, but that growth is tremendous. Mm-hmm. So Grace's was very dark and a lot of action. Joan's was also a lot of action. She had before she became a painter, she was actually a national figure skating champion on the national circuit. And so her brushstrokes, although it always annoyed her when people made this comparison, her brushstrokes always had that feeling of scratching on the ice. You know, there was a lot of short and brisk movement. And her very first painting, which she submitted to the show, which was just called Untitled, also had those marks. She also would evolve into create, you know, magnificent landscapes, abstract landscapes, and color-infused abstractions that bore no relation to this initial painting. But you can sort of see the transition through her coming years. And then Helen Frankenthaler submitted actually the large. She was the youngest person in the show, and she submitted the largest work. And it was showed some influences of Arshile Gorky, and was just really for such. She was just out of Bennington, and it was such an accomplished painting for someone her age. It too, by 1952, she'd gone well beyond where she was in 1951, but it showed a remarkable talent.
So, how did you decide on these five women to focus on in this book?
Yeah, I in my reading, well. First of all, when I came across this idea in 1990, I was interviewing Grace Hartigan, and as she was describing the scene, there were certain names that kept surfacing. Mm-hmm. And granted, this was her circle of friends and the people who influenced her. But the names that arose most often were these five among the women. And so then when I started reading all of the books that had been written, first of all, it was very hard to find references to these women at all, except in relation to the men in their lives. You know, Lee Krasner with Pollock, mm-hmm. Elaine de Kooning with Bill, Helen Frankenthaler with Clem Greenberg. But ultimately, they were the names who, to my mind, resonated because of their work, because of their influence on the movement in general. You know, they had a real impact, and also because they were 20 years separated them. Lee was 20 years older than Helen. So by focusing on these five, I could not only arguably describe women and artists who were extremely significant, but also who allowed me to tell the story of that art movement from the beginning to the end, you know, by using Lee as sort of the initial character and Helen as the last of the five.
I'm speaking with Mary Gabriel. The name of her book is Ninth Street Women: Lee Krasner, Elaine de Kooning, Grace Hartigan, Joan Mitchell, and Helen Frankenthaler, Five Painters and the Movement That Changed Modern Art. You write in your introduction that you wrote, "I am interested less in the vertical history than the horizontal one." What do you mean by that?
Well, so often I didn't want to disappoint readers who are looking for a standard biography, because it's not one, because mm-hmm. it's five people and very much about the greater movement they were part of. And so what interests me as a biographer is not necessarily the dates, you know, that kind of comprise a person's life, the date of their birth, you know, what they did, when they started school, you know, when they left home, that sort of thing. What interests me is, and I think what actually creates us, forms us all as individuals, are not so much those steps, those incremental steps, but the activities around us that impact our lives, the time in which we're born, the time in which we were raised, the influences, cultural and social, that we encounter. And I think that for these women in particular, especially for an artist whose work necessarily reflects not just themselves, but the world they live in, I thought that it was most informative to describe this, what I call the horizontal world. So, in other words, if you take the year 1945 and you look at these characters, if I just focused on them without describing, you know, the absolutely massive historical events at that time, the end of the war, the atomic bomb, the dislocation of families, the marriages that were born during the war that dissolved after the war, if I didn't talk about all of that and describe that influence on these artists, I think I would only be telling a fraction of their stories.
I do want to talk about some of the biographical details of the women in the book, because they're as fascinating as the time they lived in.
Exactly.
Lee Krasner, she comes first chronologically. What was the intellectual atmosphere like in the early 1930s? She was part of an artist union?
Right. Yeah, it was really the actual birth of what culminated 20 years later in the Ninth Street Show. During the 30s, when the Federal Art Project was formed, and actually during the Depression, there was a lot of activism on the part of artists who were, first of all, trying to survive, And so they would help each other find jobs through what you describe as the artist union. It was an offshoot of the John Reed Society, which was a communist-inspired club. The artists formed their own, and Lee was on the executive council of that, and she was in charge of organizing protests. So she described herself as having spent, you know, nights in some of New York's finest jails. She was very much at the center of this movement and one of the leaders. And basically what the artists were trying to do was they were trying to speak for themselves at this time, but they also had to address the larger political concerns, which was not just economic hardship, but rising fascism. And so some of the artists did that by becoming social realists, or what the communists called socialist realists. And they would actually paint pictures of struggling masses, you know, toiling workers, farmlands with, you know, crops that were dying. Or others, and Lee among them, went the abstract route, because that was a declaration of independence from any sort of nationalism, which these abstract artists said was actually a form of fascism. And so that was the birth of this movement. It's not a political movement, but it's essentially a political movement, because it was a declaration of freedom on the part of the artists.
When we talk about Lee Krasner, we'd love to be able to talk about her separately, and people do, especially of the work of her later years, but her name will always be associated with Jackson Pollock, obviously.
Yes.
How did their relationship, how did it impact her career?
Well, her career was actually sidelined by her relationship mm-hmm. with Pollock. Lee was a formidable figure in every way before she met him in 1941, as a painter, as an activist, as an organizer, and as an intellectual, actually, because she was credited with having the best eye in the country for the art of painting in the 1940s. When she met Pollock, she recognized her biggest passion in life was art, and he, to her mind, was the very best practitioner of that of art. She saw in his studio paintings that she said moved the earth for her in the same way that Mondrian had, that Matisse had, that Picasso had, paintings that were so new and so vital that she actually dedicated her life to making sure that the world saw these. And it wasn't just that she loved the man. I sometimes wonder, would she have loved the man if she hadn't loved his art? Mm. But in order to make sure his art was seen and that he was able to do it, she had to protect him. So Lee, as a painter, actually stepped back career-wise to promote Pollock. Lee, as an artist, never stopped working, and that was sort of a whisperer among the artists in her community, who should have known better. They should have known she would have never stopped painting, but they did. They said, you know, oh, Pollock didn't want her to, and so she didn't. In fact, she was. She had a small room in Springs where they had moved, and she was making really wonderful paintings.
And please correct me if I'm wrong, she had much more success after he died, right?
She did have more success. In 1955, before he died, she had her first really major show, which Clem Greenberg, who was arguably the most important critic on the scene, said it was probably one of the best shows of the decade. And that was a collage show she did, but that was when Lee was actually coming out from under Pollock's shadow. It's not that she thought he was a lost cause, that she would have declared that in any way, but I think in her heart she must have, because his drinking was, you know, off the charts, and he's down to creating about one painting a year. So she had to take care of herself, she had to preserve herself, and she started making these really magnificent paintings. But you're right that after Pollock's death, Lee could concentrate on herself. She was always both Lee Pollock and Lee Krasner. Lee Pollock, the person who took care of Jackson's estate, and Lee Krasner, the artist.
How is Krasner both a prototype and a warning for younger women in the same scene?
Yeah, well, the younger women actually didn't follow in her footsteps, because she was seen as socially more conservative. She was definitely the wife of Jackson Pollock. And even though she was extremely bold, I mean, you know, bold to the point that, you know, many people thought she was rude, she, you know, for what she believed in, she wasn't the person that they followed, and she wasn't the prototype for the coming artist. Now, interestingly enough, in the 70s, if we leap forward to the 70s, she became the strongest feminist of these five, and she was the one who was on the picket lines with young artists outside of MoMA demanding more attention for women. So while Pollock was alive, again, you know, she was not the one people looked to for direction or inspiration necessarily. But after he died in the 70s, she was in that role again.
We're speaking with author Mary Gabriel. Her new book, Ninth Street Women, tells the stories of five women who worked within the male-dominated world of 20th century abstract painting. They were artists in their own right. We'll continue with Mary in just a moment. This is Well, All of It. We'll be right back after the break. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and we're back with Mary Gabriel. Her new book is Ninth Street Women. Lee Krasner, Elaine de Kooning, Grace Hartigan, Joan Mitchell, and Helen Frankenthaler, five painters and the movement that changed modern art. I want to talk about Helen Frankenthaler for a moment. You write in the book, Helen was raised in the rarefied climate benefiting the family of a New York State Supreme Court judge. How did her upbringing, what impact did that have on her work as an artist and her ability to work as an artist?
Helen was one of the five. She was probably the most self-confident, and I think that's a tribute to where she came from and how she was raised. Her father, as I said, was a New York State Supreme Court judge, and he saw in Helen, his youngest daughter, this spirit. He called her a fantastic child, and so he did everything to encourage her, and everything she did, from her writing to her little, you know, child drawings, they would preserve, you know, frame or put in book form. When she entered competition, she entered once a competition in Saks at the height of the Depression, and she won, and so he bought her a charm palette, an artist palette charm from Tiffany's. So she was absolutely given, from the moment that she was, you know, cognizant of this possibility of being an artist, she was given every encouragement to do so. And that meant that by the time she was out of Bennington, she didn't go through any of the... There's no artist that doesn't go through soul searching on the canvas. So it's not fair to say Helen didn't. But she didn't show that angst. She didn't show the kind of trepidation in showing her work that, let's say, Joan Mitchell did. Joan Mitchell also came from a very wealthy family, but her father was a completely different, had a different form of parenting. And so he criticized everything Joan did. So when Joan came to the point of showing her work, she was terrified. So Helen, as I said earlier, she was very sophisticated as a young woman right out of school. And that's why by 1952, this would have been, she was on the scene for 2 years at this point. She created a work that was so confident and so original that it actually spawned a new school of painting, the Colorfield School. And I think that those massive steps that early can be attributed to her family and the actual kind of support she had early on.
You mentioned Joan Mitchell, and she, like many other artists, have been criticized historically for dressing like men and, quote, acting like men. But you disagree with this, right?
Oh, it's you know, meeting these women before they arrive in New York is so critical, because you see Joan from the time she's in high school. You know, she is Joan Mitchell. She's foul-mouthed. She's confrontative. You know, she went to a very left high school, and yet even there she assaulted her teachers and risked expulsion. She was exactly who she was before she ever arrived in New York, as were Grace Hartigan, as was Elaine de Kooning, as was Lee Krasner, you know, before she became part of the scene, and as was Helen. And what they got from the scene was the ability to be who they were. And so this, I think it was in retrospect that this sort of comment, which was essentially criticism, that they were trying to be like the boys by drinking a lot and having sort of free, having a lot of sexual relationships and you know, in Joan and Grace's case, cursing, is so unfair, because they didn't have to become boys or they didn't have to act like boys. They were already strong and independent women.
Elaine de Kooning was described by a friend as a, quote, genius at life, which I think is the greatest description ever.
Yes.
She was one of the original Chelsea girls. So tell us what that meant and what was happening at Chelsea at the time.
Chelsea was really fascinating. You know, the village was full of the WPA people, the Works Progress Administration and Federal Art Project. And Chelsea had an entirely different scene at that point. And I'm talking now late 30s still, before the United States entered the war in 41. The lofts there had been abandoned during the Depression. They had been small manufacturers. And so that's when people, artists and composers and poets, started moving in. And de Kooning, Bill de Kooning, had a studio there. And so he was part of that group. When Elaine came into his life, she was introduced to it. And she was just out of high school. And the people she met there, she said, you know, I was I was at the center of this scene. I was one genius after another, and I started thinking, you know, that this is the way life was. And they were people like Virgil Thompson and Jane and Paul Bowles and Edwin Denby and Rudy Burkhart and Lotta Lainia and Edgar Varese, you know, just an incredible cast of characters. And they were all living there because it was cheap, because they could be completely out of the world. And the life they lived was going from one studio to another, going from cafeteria to another, and exchanging ideas that once again were the things that today we take for granted, but for then were so cutting edge, no one else was paying attention to it.
And finally, you know, there's a reoccurring question in the book for so many women is whether or not to have children. And in some ways, Grace Hartigan's struggle with this question is really difficult. Can you explain to our listeners her set of circumstances?
Yeah, they all made that choice, and it was a big issue for all of them, and in fact, a lifetime disruptive issue for them. But for Grace, it had a material form, and that was in the body of her son Jeffrey. When Grace was 19, she had a son. She was ultimately married four times. This was marriage number one, and they were living in California. And the husband realized he was going to be drafted. It was the beginning of the war, and so they moved back to New Jersey. And Grace had a child at the same time that she discovered that she was an artist. She discovered this love she had for drawing and for painting, and it became all-consuming. And so as she stayed in her in-law's house while her husband was overseas with this son, working a drafting job, trying to paint on her own, she had to start making decisions. You know, who was she going to be in life? Eventually, in 1948, I think it was 47, she moved to New York with her lover by then. Her husband had decided to stay in Europe. And her lover, Ike Muse, who was her art teacher, had moved them to New York. And she had her son with her. And in 1948, she saw Pollock's first drip show at Betty Parsons Gallery. And even though it wasn't what she wanted to do on canvas, it was so strong and it spoke to her so directly that it changed her life. And after that, she couldn't do anything but be an artist. And one of the things she had to do was free herself from all personal entanglements that didn't have to do with art. Ike Muse was one of them. Her first husband was another. And unfortunately, her son Jeffrey was a third. And so she gave Jeffrey to his paternal grandparents in New Jersey, and she would see him on the weekends. And Grace had struggled with it for many years until Jeffrey ultimately moved to California with his father. But she knew that she couldn't be the mother she needed to be if she was also going to be the artist she needed to be. And there was no way she could live her life by turning her back on art, because that's who she was to the core. So it was a traumatic decision, but Grace was a very difficult person in that she had no relationships and no life outside of art. And she could be very cold in that regard. But one of her closest associates, Rex Stevens, said that what it was not a coldness necessarily. He described her as lacking a guilt chip, which he said that a lot of people who dedicate their lives to something more than what the rest of us do, which is earning a living, waking up in the morning, making sure we have food on the table and our families are taken care of, people who have to become pioneers in their field often lack this thing called a guilt chip. And they're willing to sacrifice anyone and everything to do what they need to do, and that's what Grace did.
We have just a few more minutes with Mary Gabriel. She's written the book Ninth Street Women. And you write, "I'm aware of the irony of writing about the characters as women artists." What's the irony?
Well, they would have not wanted to be in this book. none of them thought of themselves as a woman artist. I mean, in that milieu, they just didn't think of themselves that way. There wasn't an auxiliary group of women who worked next to the men, a subgroup. They were part of the scene. They weren't. Grace wouldn't even call herself an artist. She called herself a painter. And so I think that in that environment, they would have been considered secondary if they declared themselves women artists. And I think today, one of the reasons it's valid to do so is that in order to explain the history of that time, as you pointed out initially, that story is often told as a story of a few kind of macho men. But that's just one fraction of the story. At most, it's one half of the story. And the other half, which has been really neglected and therefore robs a lot of us of tradition, is that there were women in it. And so I think to draw them out momentarily, at least, if we're permitted to, and call them women artists, and describe them in that scene and really embed them in that scene as they were, I think helps us to understand the full history. And now maybe we can go on and appreciate it for what it was, which was an absolutely wonderful, incredible revolution in art.
The name of the book is Night Street Women. Lee Krasner, Elaine de Kooning, Grace Hardigan, Joan Mitchell, and Helen Frankenthaler, five painters, and the movement that changed modern art. Mary Gabriel, thank you so much for joining us in all of it.
Thank you so much, Allison.
This afternoon, Mayor de Blasio will sign a law that makes it possible for people who don't identify as a man or a woman to change their birth certificate to gender X. The legislation was passed by City Council last month in a 41-6 vote. The signing this afternoon will take place at SAGE, which is a group that advocates for LGBT seniors. Michael Adams is the CEO of that group, and he's on the line with us now. Michael, welcome to All of It.
Thank you, Allison. Happy to be with you.
So can you describe the scene at SAGE right now?
Well, it's an incredibly, incredibly exciting moment right now as we prepare for the ceremony. You know, it's just so fitting that this is happening here at SAGE because, as you mentioned, we exist for our elders, and it was transgender and gender nonconforming activists who launched our modern movement at Stonewall. That was almost 50 years ago. And so those activists are now in their 70s and 80s. They are our elders. So you can only imagine how exciting it is for our elders here as we all gear up for the arrival of the mayor and first lady and the speaker of the city council for this bill signing.
If you'd like to join this conversation and give some voice to what this change into law means for you personally, please give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Are you someone who might take this option and change your birth certificate to gender X? Michael, could you explain to people why this is important in terms of, I mean, we kind of know personally, but in terms of the legal system?
Sure. So what has happened historically is that when attempting to, for example, change a legal document, especially a birth certificate, transgender people have been required to obtain a doctor's letter or other signed affidavits from medical providers. It can obviously often be very, very invasive. And people have been forced at birth, and parents have been forced at birth, to make declarations of either male or female, when sometimes that is not the appropriate choice. And so everything about our movement, our LGBT community, including those who are transgender and gender nonconforming, has been about letting people live authentically and letting people self-determine their gender. And until today, that was not possible with birth certificates in New York City.
Now, is there an age limitation or an age range or any sort of parental consent if you're underage?
There is not. Individuals can change and seek to amend their birth certificate at any point. I mean, obviously, people come to understandings of their gender identity at various points over their lives. At SAGE, we have people who are very late in life who are making that decision and will now be able to amend their birth certificates, and other folks make it at a much younger age.
For seniors thinking about doing this, will there be any sort of difficulty or confusion when it comes to things like Social Security, just to be practical?
Well, there shouldn't be any difficulty with regard to Social Security, because Social Security does not require any gender marker. There is no gender marker on a Social Security card, and so we don't think that there will be any issues there.
What happens outside of New York City? Let's say you move to Arizona and you need a birth certificate for something that says gender X. Is there going to be difficulty at all?
Well, we hope not. We believe that these birth certificates should be honored everywhere, but they should be entitled to the full faith and credit of the law. Having said that, we know that there can sometimes be challenges, and if anybody who has such a gender X mark on their birth certificate has a problem outside New York City, our partner organization, the National Center for Transgender Equality, stands ready to assist those individuals.
Do you know how this option could be used? Can it be used by parents of newborns?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly, one of the things we've seen historically that's been a source of great pain is that parents who give birth to intersex children, children of gender that's physically indeterminate at birth, mm-hmm. have sometimes made decisions, sometimes been forced to make decisions, to declare the child one gender or the other. This now will allow those parents to choose the X option, which is a wonderful thing because it will allow somebody who is intersex to make that determination themselves, where they've arrived at the moment in time where they know what their gender identity is.
We mentioned in the intro that the legislation was passed by the city council in a 41-6 vote. The six people who voted against it, what was their argument?
Well, you know, I think we always struggle with these kinds of questions and forms of resistance when dealing with coming into full respect for people's gender identity. There are, there are some folks who have religious beliefs and are concerned that somehow this is a violation of traditional religious beliefs, that God makes folks as one thing or another, arguments of that nature. What we know over time is that we live in a country with many, many different types of religious beliefs. None of those can be the basis for public policy. Instead, we need to focus on the individual's right to make their own decisions, their own personal rights, and their own right to choose what's healthy for them.
You know, there are some advocates on the other side of this that say that this should go further, shouldn't have gender on birth certificates at all.
I think that is a great argument, and that we always need to ask the question, wherever there is a gender marker, whether it's on a birth certificate or anything else, we need to ask the question, why is it there? Is there a reason for it to be there? These questions can be asked on a case-by-case basis, but certainly it's our perspective that if there is not a compelling reason for a gender marker, then it shouldn't be there at all.
Michael Adams, CEO of SAGE. Thank you so much for joining us and walking us through today's big event.
All right. It's great talking with you, Allison. Bye-bye.
This is All of It. We'll be right back after the break with Tandy Newton. Yeah. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Our next guest is someone who you might know from her stellar performance in HBO's Westworld, for which she recently won the Emmy for Best Supporting Actress in a Drama. And believe it or not, it's been 20 years since Tandy Newton wowed audiences in the film adaptation of Toni Morrison's Beloved. Her latest project places her not in front of the camera, but rather in the executive producer's chair. She's one of the EPs of a documentary called Liana, which weaves together both live footage and animation and is narrated by the film's subjects, children at an orphanage in Swaziland. Part documentary and part narrative, the film tells two stories at once, that of the children and also that of the powerful girl named Liana, whose story the children create as the film progresses. The film premieres tonight at the IFC Center, and Tandy Newton joins me today in studio. Nice to see you.
Oh, it's lovely to see you too.
This is so exciting. How did you come to produce this film, to EP on this film?
Yeah, what a privilege. I actually became friends with a documentary maker, Sharmeen Obaid Chinoy from Pakistan, who...
We had her on.
Oh, Sharmeen, she's so... gosh,
2 weeks
she's one
ago.
Of my absolute idols. She's got a new movie coming out, yeah. And she and I became friends, and her cinematographer was Aaron, who is the filmmaker of Liana. And at that time, I think they were struggling with finance because this was a labor of love mm-hmm. that took, 8 years to bring to life. And Aaron is from Swaziland, grew up there, and it was very close to his heart. But, it's hard, like I said, to get people interested. So she felt that I would, and she was absolutely right, would love the material, would really want to get involved and could help them mm-hmm. both financially, but also guiding them into the industry, the mainstream entertainment. And it's been... honestly, 4 years of just complete joy, and as like I said, it's such a privilege to be part of it.
When you watch the film, it seems ridiculous that it would be hard to get someone interested.
I know, right?
Yet it is. Why is it?
Well, the best projects tend to be. It's only afterwards that then studios are trying to emulate what was done mm-hmm. with no money at all. Right. It's what was your question?
Like, why would it be so hard to get a film made?
Well,
like
because
this?
It's, you know, this was, I think, Aaron and Amanda, they were doing this outside of their other jobs, frankly. Mm-hmm. This was not paying the bills. And so it took a long time, you know, little chunks of money here and there. And when I came on board, I was able to, you know, help them find much bigger, you know, pockets of money and to introduce them to people. And I used, you know, my address book, I guess, mm-hmm. and having been doing this for a long time. But also, I think because of the, you know, as an activist who's worked a lot in Africa, mm-hmm. who, you know, I've met a lot of people who really care about how people in that part of the world are portrayed and how incredibly important and valuable it is to have stories like Liana, which allow for a connection mm-hmm. between, you know, those in the West, to use that dreadful term, and the developing world. And, you know, that connectiveness is crucial to how we're going to move forward as a, you know, as a humanity.
I have to imagine that is the upside of celebrity.
It most certainly is. It's the only good thing about it, frankly. It's, I mean, I don't bemoan the fact that I've done well, mm-hmm. but, you know, I'm thrilled that I've, you know, but celebrity is like a whole industry in itself. It's not about the work. It's this other bit that makes people a lot of money, you know, whether it's magazines or, you know, photographs. It's the kind of the fantasy bit that is unattainable by people, you know. So, you know, they dream. It's the stuff that they dream about. But yes, to actually find a use for it, which is to help and mm-hmm. encourage an audience to be interested about things that matter to them, they just maybe don't know about. They don't realize it.
So it's really interesting in this film that the children narrate the film, but they're clearly also talking about their own lives well.
Yeah.
Why was it important to make sure that this story was truly the children's story, not like, hey guys, read this about Liana, that this really evolved from them?
I think that it was the need. Mm-hmm. Aaron and Amanda, having spent a lot of time there, Aaron's father actually runs the farm where the orphanage is located. And, you know, these families' lives have been ravaged by HIV and by issues that the world has a duty to really recognize. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, something that we know is happening right through Africa. And it was important that the children told their story so that we could actually believe the truth and reality of it. And also because they are absolutely enchanting.
They're great storytellers.
They're enchanting. you know, these kids don't have families. Their parents have died from AIDS and attending problems around that. And they have joy and they're fierce and they're funny. How could you not want to spend an hour just enchanted by them? I think it was basically Aaron and Amanda as filmmakers just realizing that they had the value of these kids on screen would be extraordinary. And it's true, they are. And what's so magical is that I call it sacrifice, the fact that Aaron and Amanda just put their lives into this mm-hmm. For that number of years, that the payoff is going to be enormous because the film is magical. It's beautifully shot. The kids are just the best movie stars I've ever seen, practically, and there's loads of them. And what it will do to help, you know, raise awareness about what's happening in Swaziland and by extension Africa, what it will allow not just children but adults to feel this connectedness with people that maybe they just see as, you know, they're the forgotten ones. They're mm-hmm. the silenced people in the world. They're the ones you don't care about, you know, and that's not a good thing. You know, we gain so much from Africa and the resources that come from there. There's so much that we wouldn't even be able to do without these resources. And it's just out of gratitude and awareness, we have a duty to know these people. And they're there offering up friendship in a way mm-hmm. when you meet them on screen. So it's a joyful thing. And I just love the fact that as opposed to a news feed where you see, you know, fly-ridden kids with kwashiorkor and you know, poverty and yet another tragic story. And of course, they're happening all the time from that part of the world. You know, that we actually get to see the tenacity and perseverance and just survival instincts of these incredible young people who are just like my children, your children, everybody's children. And, you know, the fact that one of the lines in the movie is hold on to hope, that these kids can hold on to hope when they've been through what they've been through. It is, well, I've got goosebumps, if you could see it. Listeners, the goosebumps on my arm. Just that is just inspiration for your day. You know, whether you want to help them in Swaziland or not, it's going to improve your day because it inspires you. The fact that these kids can be so tenacious and hopeful and joyful and grateful for their lives when we have so much, and yet, you know, we still find it hard to get up in the morning.
Find a way to complain about the frozen yogurt.
Yeah,
being
I mean,
too long.
Literally, it's like
right?
Watch Liana and feel great for a week. Like that is my. There's the advert
there's
for
your,
the movie.
Watch your elevator
Liana,
pitch.
Guaranteed. Watch Liana and feel amazing for a fortnight.
We're talking to Tandy Newton about her new film Liana. One of the things I'm going to describe it for listeners. And so these young men, and there's a little girl in it too.
Who they're, well, there are lots of girls.
Yeah, they're describing their. They're describing this, they're making up a story about this fierce little warrior girl, Liana. And I do want to play a little bit of audio of their describing, just so they can get people can get a sense of like how great storytellers they are, them describing her coming to the water's edge. Let's take a listen.
Liana was up the hill. Then, at the top of the hill, ocean. Wow. I've never seen this before. And they say, what a huge and a beautiful river. They saw the whale going, coming out and making a big splash again.
Liana is looking out, thinking, where does the water end?
So there's all this beautiful animation while they're
so
discussing it.
The poetry in the way they think, the way they describe. I mean, it's so true, and it just comes from a source of such innocent purity, you know? And you would think that the stuff these kids have been through, that their innocence would be destroyed. And it hasn't been. You know, the ability to rise up again and again. And that's something that we need to be filled with, that hope and aspiration. You know, everything that's going on in the world, how difficult it is, particularly for women, for people of color. You know, sometimes it's hard to think there's a reason to get up in the morning. There's a reason to keep persevering, you know, and these kids show you the way. It's a human resource that we have in ourselves to just rise above. And it's not just, you know, one or two people that have that extraordinary gift. We all have it, and we've got to access it. And I think so much of the drudgery of our lives and the layer upon layer of stuff and things that we listen to and watch is just this constant kind of heaviness, when if we just take that away, strip it away, and just are left with ourselves and our capabilities to just rise and know what's right, know what's true. And there is nothing like being connected to another human being that reminds you that you have that, you know, that reminder that we have this strength, we have this ability. And just to get rid of all the crap. And I just, you know, I watch the movie, and that's, you hear their voices just now, these kids. They burn a path through hopelessness and through disaster, and they find light. And It's magical. It's magical. And the filmmakers have done an extraordinary job in bringing that, you know, to life, both by the interviews with the children and focusing on them, you know, physically in life, but also this animation, this beautiful animation. Nigerian artist who actually lives in San Diego, and they spent a long time looking for him, and he spent time in, you know, with Swazi children, and you know, everything that he has illustrated comes from, you know, the pure realness of what's around them. And, you know, what a privilege to be able to witness that as an audience, that authenticity. It's a bolt of truth, you know, right into your solar plexus. It's pretty powerful.
They're guided very gently but firmly by this magnificent storyteller.
Gina, yeah.
And part of the storytelling, what you get from them, and kids do this all the time, is that they let you know their fears and their concerns through the story. Mm. If you would share with the audience, what were some of the fears and concerns the kids expressed through Liana's story?
Through Liana's story, yeah. They, because they were obviously protected by the fact that it was it's fiction, and they could give Liana struggles to overcome, which they obviously know about. These are 10-year-old children, and they're, you know, they talk about, disease, mm-hmm. HIV. They talk, you know, violence and rape. Mm-hmm. And these aren't things that they necessarily give words to, but it's alluded to in the way they, you know, tell the story. And these very heavy themes have gone on in their lives. Otherwise, how on earth would they know about it? Mm-hmm. They don't have TV to watch. You know, this is from their lives. And they give Liana these obstacles to overcome because they believe that it is possible to overcome, you know, and they hope that it is possible because their lives rely on it being possible.
There's another clip I want to play that's to your point of them having a sense of, even though they're telling this fantastic story, about the reality of the lives that they face. Let's play that.
Liana's mother becomes sick too.
She's going to die soon. Soon, soon. Soon, soon. 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 They have a sickness. They have AIDS. Liana, she was trying her best to take care of her mother. Liana said, "Mother, please don't leave me." And then the mother said, "She's too late." And Liana tries and begs and begs. The mother said, "Please take care of the family and be a good girl." Liana said, "Mother, and then she finds that it is too late. She knows that the future will be tough."
It's heartbreaking. HIV/AIDS and related diseases the number one killer.
It is.
In Swaziland.
Yeah.
Aside from, there's a beauty in the film, there's the heartbreaking, there's the joy and the laughter. When people leave the theater, what do you hope they take away with them?
I hope that they take away a sense of kinship with the experience of the children. It might not be AIDS, it might not be domestic violence, it might not be, you know, any of the things specifically that the children have been through, but we all feel the same pain. We all have been children afraid. And it's that that sense of connection to the plight of these children and the, like I said, the human kinship that is what I hope people will take away, because then it will inspire a keenness to perhaps help them in Swaziland and become more knowledgeable about what's going on, but also how we intend to help ourselves, you know, get through what we're going through. That's what I mean about the gift these children give us in the movie, is we can overcome. We can be bright and hopeful of what tomorrow brings. And that's their gift to us. And it's an unconditional gift, because here's the film, there it is. And it's what helps them get through their days. So it's twofold, you know. It's our intention, how we think we might be able to give these kids more hope and support, and also how we're going to help ourselves. It's two sides of the same thing.
Liana opens tonight, premieres tonight at IFC in New York. Tanya Newton, will you come back so we can talk about you and your work next time?
Yeah, I would love to.
Tanya Newton, thank you so much for joining us. That's our show. Thanks for listening to All of It. Join us tomorrow at noon on WNYC. All of It is produced by Megan Ryan, Rosie Guerin, Catherine Millsop, Andres O'Hara, Joseph Cabuglione, and Ursula Summer. Matt Mirando is our engineer, and Luscious Jackson does our theme music. I'm Allison Stewart. You can follow All of It on Instagram and at Twitter at All of It WNYC. Thanks for listening.